right now in the studio from Bass and Rec. It's Bob Radke. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, in Park City.
Yeah, so what have you got going on?
Hey, well, first thing, we have a small little running event out in the Glenwild area this tomorrow morning. There, Bass and Rec is putting on a little trail run. It'll be going up Flying Dog and back down through the Glenwild Loop and Stealth and back to the trailhead at East Canyon Creek. So it all starts at East Canyon Creek Trailhead and ends there. It's about a 28-kilometer trail run. They're going clockwise, so they should be off Flying Dog by the time most of the people get there to start riding there. We've been working on a project for a couple of years to put bathrooms at the East Canyon Creek Trailhead behind Jeremy Ranch Elementary School. They are open. We have finally got that going. We just have a few punch list items that we're working on to get it tidied up. But it's open and to the public. And just trying to spread out the parking use and trail opportunities for people and make it a little more a better place for people to use.
So they're flush toilets or just okay?
No, yeah. Flush toilets. We've had a porta potty there for a number of years, and we have two bathrooms and plenty of parking. So it's a great place to access Flying Dog and the Glenwild Loop. And so, yeah, we're excited to finally have that project buttoned up. So, and speaking of parking, we've been going through some overuse at Rob's Trail. You know, a lot of people go up there and use it. Just a reminder, people, we've been working with the county and the neighborhood up there to try to clean up the parking issues that we have. And so we're asking people that, you know, if the, you know, legal parking spots are full, please maybe go down and start your hike or bike on Collins Trail at the bottom, park at the Park City Community Church or somewhere else. The county sheriff's department will start issuing tickets and towing people at Rob's Trail. So, it's 16, 17 parking spots there, and normally we can see up to 35 cars on a busy weekend. So,
oh, wow. So Ticketing and towing, that's not going to be cheap.
No.
All right. And is it causing a problem for people using the road?
Yeah, it's getting narrowed down, and we have some of the trail users, it's kind of, the county sees it as a little safety issue if people are blocking the driveways when they're parking. They're getting close to people's driveways and the residents can't get out. We have people using the residents' yards for photo shoots and whatnot. So we just ask that people please respect the homes and the residents in the area.
Yeah. And any plans to try and expand the parking there?
We're going to make it a little safer. We looked at that. It's going to cost a little bit of money, so it's on next year's budget. And we'll go up there and create it a little safer. Don't know we'll get many parking spots there. So we just need to hopefully one of our plans, you know, with the working with Utah Olympic Park and everything was to expand our options in that area. So you can park down at the RTS trailhead below Utah Olympic Park and use that trail system. It's all connected now with the RTS and the BLT trail up to the Yeti and bobsled and the Utah Olympic Park and Iron Bill and all that stuff is connected. So there's lots of options in that area, and it would be great to see some of that use get spread out.
Okay. Anything else, Bob?
Hey, nope. Just have a great weekend, everybody. The weather's getting great, a lot nicer and cooler. It's a great time to get out and use the trails.
Yeah, we need some rain.
Yes.
Okay, Bob Radke with Basin Rec. Thanks. Well, Park City and the Utah Department of Transportation launching an environmental assessment study before any improvements can be made to State Route 248. That means it could be another 2 years before there's some traffic relief for Park City's back door. While a new bus line, the Camas Connector, was launched with the hope of getting cars off of 248, that line of vehicles coming into Park City still backs up every morning. Several years ago, at Park City's request, UDOT pulled down the concrete barriers there in order to add another traffic lane. With new transit sales taxes approved by voters, Park City and Summit County have the money to make improvements. 248 is high on that list. The plan has been to add an HOV or BRT, the High Occupancy Vehicle or Bus Rapid Transit Lane, to 248. UDOT Public Information Officer John Gleason told us that they are at the very initial stages and now looking at everything.
We know that we have a congestion issue on SR-248, but this environmental assessment will kind of help determine what those issues are and what needs to happen in order to solve them. And that's really what this whole process is about, is getting to the bottom of what the issue is and what needs to happen to find a resolution.
The environmental assessment, known as NEPA, is the National Environmental Policy Act, and it must be followed. Last month, UDOT mailed out letters to those property owners, identified as one that may need to be accessed to complete the necessary survey work for this project. Gleason says the study area is broad, so all alternatives can be considered. With a hillside to the north and a wetland to the south, he says widening the highway could be an option, but again, it has to be studied first. He says UDOT won't just restripe the highway to make additional traffic lanes. A full-fledged study is required and every possible option examined. It's estimated to be a 16-month process.
What we're doing right now, Leslie, is we're studying a broad area, which is very common with any kind of a potential project like this. We want to know what the impacts are going to be, not only on SR-248, but the surrounding areas as well. And also, you want to be able to examine any possibility. It doesn't mean that an alternative suggested alternative will meet the criteria or even make sense. But we want to make sure that we're looking at a very broad area there, so that we can look at every possible alternative.
That's John Gleason, KPCW News Time now, 8:23. With an estimated 10,000 DACA cardholders in Utah, this week's news that the program is being ended as we know it has created a lot of anxiety and uncertainty for the future. One of those who holds a DACA card and is part of the program is Enrique Sanchez, a Park City High School graduate, a student at Salt Lake Community College, and an employee at the PC Mark. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so tell us your story, Enrique. My understanding is that you were a toddler when your parents brought you to Utah?
Yes, that's right. So I'm originally from Mexico, Guerrero, and I moved to Park City at the age of two. My parents always spoke Spanish to me at home, and then I learned English in preschool through the Park City School District, actually. So I went through the entire Park City School system from McPullen to Eckerd to Treasure, and then graduating from Park City High in 2016.
Yeah, so growing up here, I mean, what have your parents told you about why they came to Utah from Mexico with you and then just stayed?
So my dad originally has lived here since 1992 when he got a job locally here in Park City. After I was born, he decided that it was better to have his whole family here instead of being apart from us. So he moved us all out here in 2000. You know, they've always told us that the reason why we're here, why they left their families, is so that we could have a better life, better education, so that we don't have to suffer the way they suffered. And instead of working with our backs, working with our brains.
Yeah. So we hear, like, kids like you, I mean, they don't realize that they're undocumented until they go to apply for a job or get a driver's license. So you were aware of the situation growing up?
I think when I became the most aware was in the summer of 2012, when one of my school counselors, Ms. Amendola at Ecker Hill, actually nominated me for a camp that was held up in Stanford University in California. And I told my mom about it, that the school had nominated me and that I really wanted to go. And her biggest concern was me flying, since I was undocumented and there wasn't any, you know, I wasn't able to get a state ID since I wasn't a U.S. citizen. So I really didn't have any form of identification other than my Mexican passport.
So were you able to go, or did you have to miss out?
I was. So Miss Amendola, she had the right people speak to my parents, and they ultimately decided that it was something that they wanted me to do. And I was very nervous flying after that, just because I knew what the risk was. And, you know, my parents told me what you know, why they were concerned about it. And so ultimately I did, I was able to go, and I had a great time. I learned so much, and I'm so grateful for that opportunity.
So what kind of stress and anxiety does living here undocumented have had on you and your family?
It's just always that concern that, you know, you can be taken away, your parents could be taken away at any time. You don't know if in the morning it's the last time you'll see your parents. You know, if they're driving to work and they're speeding a little bit, they get pulled over or something. You never know what's going to happen.
So at what point did you then register for a DACA card?
So it was 2012 when President Obama actually established DACA. And I applied for DACA in 2013 when I was a sophomore in high school. And that's when I received it. It's a very long process. It's not very simple. It's not what most people think, you know, that, oh, you're an undocumented immigrant that got here when you were a child. It's very difficult to prove that you were here before that certain date that they established and, you know, really show that you are a person that is here for the right reasons and isn't here to commit any crimes or things like that.
So what has having a DACA card then allowed you to do?
So many things. And I honestly, I don't think I would be where I am today without it. So the first thing that it did for me, I was able to get my job at Fresh Market as a courtesy clerk. That was my junior year of high school. And I was able to work and save up some money for college and help my parents out with bills and things like that. And then in the spring of 2016, I learned about an exchange program that Park City High School does with Cristobal France, which is the sister city of Park City. And I applied for what's called advanced parole, which is essentially a type of visa that allows DACA recipients to travel outside of the United States for educational or humanitarian purposes. And in August of 2016 was basically the part one of the exchange when the French students arrived in Park City. And I hosted one of the exchanges for 3 months. And at that point, I was just very uncertain if I was even going to be able to do part two, which was me going to France and doing what she was doing here.
And did that happen?
It did, yeah. So actually, 2 weeks before my trip, I got the news that I really prayed for it on the daily. And that's when my advanced parole document arrived. I had already gotten my plane tickets. All my luggage was set. All I was waiting for was that advanced parole. And luckily, I did receive it, and I got to experience high school. I got to learn about the culture. I got to speak the language for 3 months. And then ultimately, I returned to the U.S. with no problem.
Yeah. So you have younger siblings who were born here, making them American citizens. Is that tough, knowing that essentially, they have more rights than you do, and yet you're brother and sister?
I don't see it that way. You know, they're my family, and I'm super grateful that they don't have to go through what my sister and I are going through. I tell them, I emphasize to them the importance of college and education, and I just tell them, you know, that they're really lucky to have been able to born in this country because they qualify for so many things, and I just really tell them to take advantage of those things that I wasn't able to take advantage of.
So what would you like to see happen in Congress? Because, of course, that's where this is all headed when the announcement was made, is that Congress has now 6 months to deal with it. What would you like to see happen?
I definitely want to see Congress step up and make a move so that these current 800,000 DACA recipients have a pathway to citizenship. And, you know, these people have proven to be top citizens of the U.S. And, you know, we're not criminals. We're not anything like that. We're just here to live our life. This is the only life we've known. We're here to study. We're here to make a better future for ourselves and hopefully our families in the future.
Yeah. Do you feel like you're a pawn in this, a bargaining chip? Because we hear what, you know, the administration did this as a way to force Congress to deal with the immigration issue.
I honestly don't think that that's their actual reasoning. I feel like that's just kind of a cover-up to make it seem a little less heartless, because I honestly think that this is a heartless act from this administration to basically pick on these 800,000 students who have done nothing wrong and are just trying to live their life in the country that they know.
And this is certainly speculation, but what would happen in the 2 years or whenever your DACA card expires and the program has not been renewed? I mean, as long as you remember, of course, this is your home. I mean, is there a place that you can even be deported to?
Right, exactly. So, you know, I actually just was reading an article that I believe the White House has released a memo or something like that, that essentially the Department of Homeland Security is urging DACA recipients to use their remaining time on their work authorization to prepare and arrange their departure from the United States. So that really makes me nervous, just because that's kind of telling me these next 2 years that I have left on my work permit are my last 2 years here in the U.S., and I'm ultimately going to have to prepare to return to Mexico, where I do have family, but my family there recognizes that I'm American because I've lived here my entire life. I've grown up next to Americans. I pledge allegiance to the flag every day in school and stuff. They are very happy with us that, you know, we still consider ourselves Mexican, because we are. We're Mexican by blood, but we grew up here and we're American as well.
Yeah, or do you just stay like many illegal undocumented immigrants have and then just, you know, deal with the odds that you don't get caught?
That's the thing. That's why we're very afraid, because when we first signed up for DACA, the conditions were that we were to basically give all our personal information and let the government know that we're here illegally. So now that this administration has all of this information, what are they going to do when they learn that our work permits has expired? Are they going to come after us? Are they going to come just for us? Or are they going to go into our homes and take our family?
So my guess is that if it wasn't renewed, that you then would go back to Mexico, because that really may be the only chance you would ever have of getting a green card or a work permit to come back, huh?
That's correct, yes, yeah. I mean, there's nothing I would be able to do here. I wouldn't be able to take care of myself. I wouldn't be able to work if my work permit expired. I'm currently a sophomore in college, and my plans are honestly, I'm not sure what I'm going to do right now, because I'm currently an associate degree for criminal justice, and I just don't know if I want to switch degrees so that I can go into something else if my plan is to return to Mexico. Because my career goals and my dreams have always been to work in law enforcement since I was little, and I'm not going to be able to do that here in the U.S. If I'm not a U.S. citizen, I'm not going to be able to be a police officer, or my ultimate goal of the national level, CIA or FBI. So I really have to think about what degree I want to get here in the U.S., if it's criminal justice and I'm going to want to pursue my dreams in Mexico, or if I'm going to have to get something else that will allow me to do better in life in Mexico.
That's DACA participant Enrique Sanchez. KPCW News Time now, 8. First, coming up this Wednesday, a fundraiser to help save our historical mining site and relics. In the studio with details, I have Park City Museum Director Sandra Morrison and Marianne Cohn. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So when and where and how much?
So Wednesday, September 13th and 6th until about 10 o'clock at the Legacy Lodge. And it's basically a buffet and ribbon cutting, and we have Small House Strings playing, and a fundraiser to preserve our mining structures. So Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History are putting it on in conjunction with Park City Mountain Resort. And, yeah, we just want everybody to come Tickets are available online at our website, parkcityhistory.org.
Okay. And then again, as you mentioned, all the money goes to support mine site stabilization. We've done a lot of work. Marianne, you want to tell us about what needs to be done still?
Oh, well, we have five other sites that we're working on. The California Comstock's not quite done, but it's been a really good fundraiser for that one. It's looking awfully good. And then the King Kong Counterweight is done. We'll put a couple of balloons up there so people know where it is. People really have probably skied by it and not thought about it. Anyway, then we've got five more. But when I was the museum director in the 90s, we did an ethnic exhibit, and we had an ethnic Celebrate Your Roots party, and it was really a good time. Because Park City's always been diverse. Mining towns are that way. People come from everywhere to mine, and they get along. And I think we're still a tolerant community. And so it's celebrating Park City's roots, and everybody who comes celebrate their roots if they can wear something from their past. I have my husband's tam o'shanter. Sure, it's a little too large. Probably won't be able to see. Anyway, I think it's going to be a good time, and it does help people. And Vail has done an amazing menu. And there are seven different stations from seven different countries, food from different countries.
Okay.
So, be a good time.
What about the Daly West Mine in Deer Valley there near the Montage? Is that on the list of things to be fixed?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't have anything not on the list at this point. We're back in 2007, I had a structural engineer, and I got a grant from the National Trust, and we looked at some of the closer structures like the King Kong Counterweight and the Orban and Jupiter Bowl. And so I had some plans that were ready to go on how to preserve the structures. And so that's what we've been working on, you know, this summer. And I also received a grant from the National Trust, so the structural engineer is actually up at the Little Bell, Orban, which is up in Deer Valley. He's actually up there this month putting together plans so we can start work on those. And we also just recently went to look at the conveyor belt that goes from the Thames shaft across to the giant waste rock dump. It's on a particular lean, and so looking at what we'll do next summer with that as well, because we don't want that to fall over. So it's sort of what rises to the top we work on first, and how much money do we have. Obviously, there's some really big buildings out there, like the head frame at the Silver King at the Bonanza Chairlift and the mill building right there. I mean, you know, those are going to be in the millions. And would be better served to actually find some kind of adaptive reuse. Or bins and structures like that, you know, we can just shore them up and they're great yard art and we can all just enjoy them. They don't need a use.
Okay. So again, people can help out with the effort by attending Wednesday's
dinner. Right, Wednesday's dinner, yeah. And as Marianne said, we have, you know, this huge buffet and the band Small House Strings is playing, so it's just going to be a really fun event.
Okay. Auction off a couple of chairlifts that they all has donated.
Yeah.
All right, Park City History. Mining history. KPCW News Time now, 8:41. Well, some 70 Park City and Summit County residents have spent the last few days in Boulder, Colorado as part of this year's City Road Tour. Two of those are Summit County Councilmember Roger Armstrong and Park City Councilmember Nan Worrell. They agreed to give us an update and their impressions of this tour. First on the line, I have Roger. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So you spent most of yesterday in meetings with your Boulder counterparts. It appeared that there aren't too many philosophical differences, I guess, between Boulder County and Boulder City. I think maybe a lot like we see here.
I think that's right. I think, first of all, that there's a lot of consistency between those two entities, Boulder City and Boulder County. They both perceive issues like climate change and affordable housing and transportation to be the challenges that they need to solve. So they work really well together. And they're working hard on those issues separately. There's a real disconnect, not a disconnect, there's a real difference between the city and the county physically. So all of the cities within Boulder County are where they want the density to be, and they want the county areas to be extremely rural. So they tend to, if the county is working on affordable housing issues, they do it jointly and regionally with their city partners. But that housing is generally located within the city limits as opposed to in the county.
Yeah, and I know we've talked over the years about incorporating the Snyderville Basin, but I guess it just doesn't work anymore. with the legislation that we have on the books. But in terms of parking and transportation, you heard some statistics. 43% of Boulder's employees drive to town in single occupancy vehicles. Do we have any idea how we compare with that?
Well, you know, if you look at ridership, maybe that's a better way to look at it. If you look at the ridership on transit, I think they're around 9% ridership. I think we're at about 2%. So they have more ridership on transit. They have significant ridership on bicycles. I mean, I think that's a much larger number. The 45% single car, I'm guessing that we probably aren't looking that good. I think we probably have significantly larger percentage than that of our workforce that drives in.
Yeah, so any great ideas in Boulder than how we would increase our ridership or decrease our single occupancy trips?
You know, on the county side, we talked a little bit about it yesterday. They have a rapid transit district, so the city and the county don't control the transit district. I think it's, you know, a multi-jurisdiction partnership that actually participates in it. And in Boulder County, they incentivize or try and get employers to encourage employees to take transit in. And their transit system is a fare-based system. So it's, I think, $2 or $2.50 for local rides, and then it can increase from there for regional transit. And in those areas where they've made it free, they've had a substantially higher adoption of transit ridership. So I think that, you know, we're probably a little bit ahead just because we've got a free bus system. We know that as soon as you start charging for transit ridership, you start losing riders. So our free bus system, I think, helps. The fact that we started to increase the efficiency of our system, they've got 10-minute head times, I think, on some of their routes. And I think, you know, switching to our express system from Kendall Junction into Park City helps to address some of those issues. So I think we're aligned in that way. They were very interested, actually, in our electric bike share. They've got what they call the B-Bikes in Boulder, which is a bike share system. They've got extensive bike trails around Boulder that are separate from the transportation corridors, and that really enables them to take advantage of bikes. And they also have a huge university population. So the people that are willing to take bikes are also a core part of that population as well.
Yeah, but I heard that there was some kind of presentation about the number of accidents and collisions between pedestrians and bikes. So that sounded kind of alarming.
Well, it sounds alarming. You know, anytime you talk about collisions, it is. But, you know, when you look at the overall numbers, they're relatively low. I think they've had 2 deaths in 5 years. On bicycles, they've had 5 or 6 deaths in 5 or 6 years with pedestrians. And, you know, it's funny. Again, you've got a fairly young town. You've got university. I shouldn't laugh. You've got university students that are heads down, you know, looking at their cell phones and texting as they're walking. And that's probably not a good result when you've got a busy city with a lot of traffic and people, you know, will step out in front of cars. But they've got some innovative ways of dealing with it. They've actually stenciled the streets with a slogan that says, a big yellow banner that says Heads Up Boulder, as you get to an intersection that's in design. If you've got your head down texting, you actually see that, and it makes you look up to make sure you're not going to get run over. So the good news is they address it. It didn't strike me as unusually high numbers, but I don't know what our local numbers are. You know, we don't tend to have a lot of fatalities in the basin that I'm aware of, so I think we're doing pretty well there.
All right. Is Nan still available to talk?
She is. You want to talk to her?
Yes, thanks.
She is much more conscious than I am this morning. Hang on one second.
Thanks, Roger. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Again, we're checking in with a couple of our elected officials participating in this year's City Road Tour to Boulder, Colorado. On the phone with me now, Park City Council Member Nan Worrell. Good morning, Nan.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, so we had heard that Boulder has a parking district. Rather than asking businesses to pay for individual parking impacts or being required to, you know, have a minimum parking number, apparently businesses there all pay an assessment for parking. So is that decided on square footage, business use, or does just everybody pay into it?
Everybody pays into it. It's really a fascinating concept that they've got going on here. The businesses are charged as part of their property tax, and so it's an add-on to the property tax. And then that goes into a separate fund. And from that fund, parking is managed. And they really believe that paid parking is really an important element of successfully managing their traffic issues. And it's important to them that they integrate enforcement into the program. And, you know, so people know that there are consequences and they're going to be enforced if parking rules are violated. And they also have a huge focus within their districts on education.
Yeah, so you spent some time, I'm guessing, at the Pearl Street Mall. I'm not sure if you were on that tour, but apparently it's this funky pedestrian mall. Any chance that something like that could happen to our Main Street one day?
You know, I know that that concept has been visited many times in the past, and for a variety of reasons it hasn't gone on through, so... at this point in time, that's not something that we're talking about.
Yeah, is it something we look at as we design the new art and culture district?
I think it's certainly something that can always be looked at. Is, you know, how do we make the experience great for pedestrians and then, you know, keep them away from the cars? I know you already talked to Roger about, you know, the things that they're doing now to try to cut down on the number of pedestrian auto accidents that are going on.
Now, you also met with Boulder City Council and heard how they're trying to set up their own municipal electric utility and the struggles with that. Can you contrast that with how Park City's trying to negotiate with Rocky Mountain Power?
They feel really strongly that in order for them to achieve their energy goals, they've got to be able to control the utility that provides the energy. And so they've been working on this since about 2011, and they're running into, as you can imagine, all sorts of technical challenges of how do you actually do that. They have some legal battles because, as you can imagine, their energy provider is not excited about them doing this. And then just basic communication challenges, trying to let the population, the residents, know what is going on with that. And yet, because there's litigation going on, they can't always, you know, reveal everything. So it's difficult for them. And when we met jointly as councils, we brought up how we were talking with Rocky Mountain Power and perhaps having them create essentially our own little grid for us. And they were very interested in that. And so we're going to be sharing information with them about our approach with Rocky Mountain Power to see if there's some way that they might be able to either shift horses or just work that into what it is that they're doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, is Park City still considering trying to form its own municipal electric utility, or we're just decided to work with Rocky Mountain Power? And
we're working with Rocky Mountain Power.
All right. There was also a discussion of regulating short-term rentals like Airbnb and VRBO. Did you learn anything from that discussion that could help us here in Park City?
They actually are working with Airbnb, and when listings go up about properties, the license number for that property is also listed, so it's easier for them, and they have a paralegal that actually can track, you know, so if someone is listing on Airbnb and isn't licensed in the city of Boulder, then they are able to take action that way.
Okay. I mean, we do something similar, don't we? I mean, by checking? Oh, I thought we had some kind of software that regulated or at least found out what kind of units, what units are doing short-term rentals.
As I recall, the county had that software, and then the provider of that company or that software went out of business. And then Utah has had some changes in the laws regarding, you know, regulating nightly rentals and stuff. So I think our next step will be to reach out to Airbnb perhaps and see how we might be able to work with them.
Okay. I know you need to get back. But, Nan, appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you when we get back in town.
It's Park City Council Member Nan Worrell. You're listening to KPCW News Time now, 8:52. Good morning. Well, the Summit County Health Department hosting its second Farmers Market on Tuesday. In the studio with me, I have Serene Brooks, health educator, along with the Environmental Health Director, Phil Bondurant. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Serene, we'll start with you. When and where again at the health department?
Okay, so on Tuesday, September 12th, from noon to 4, we're going to host our second Farmers Market. And we'll have lots of fresh produce available for community members, as well as the opportunity for those with Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits. The SNAP benefits, they're welcome to come and bring their EBT cards. They can use those at our market. And along with that, for the first $10 they spend, they get back an extra $10 in fresh produce.
Okay. And so you've got the produce coming from where? I know that you've been using some of the inmate garden.
Yes. Produce. We're really excited about the partnership we've developed with the inmates. They've expanded their garden this year, and they've we've been able to go in and do some education and help them learn how to do some gardening skills. And so they're going to be bringing some fresh produce as well to sell at the market. And it's a really good opportunity for them to come and interact with the community and community to interact with them. We've also, I would like to recognize that we do have partners with the Summit Community Garden and the USU Extension. They've helped us a great deal with this market. So.
Okay, so how many other farmers do you have?
We should have about five vendors there selling produce, and so that part will be, we're really excited about it.
All right. And again, we've got markets, farmers markets in town already. Why did you think we needed, another one?
Well, we felt this was an important component to get fresh produce out to the community members. So this farmer's market is just a farmer's market. It's fresh produce, and it was also our opportunity to partner with the Sheriff's Department and an opportunity for the inmates to grow a garden. We also were going to have a car seat checkpoint available that day, and that we're excited about as well. People can bring their vehicles with their car seats in it and learn how to correctly install their car seat, get some education on the safety aspect of car seats. Surprisingly, 75% of Summit County members do not install their car seats correctly. So it's an important part. And if people would like to come bring their car seat over and just check it out and see if they're doing it right or see if they could maybe learn something, we'd love to have them come over.
3 out of 4, that means they're installed incorrectly.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yikes. So you plan to do this again then next year? I mean, has it been successful enough to?
Yeah, it's been a success. We're really excited about what happened at the first market, and we're hoping to just let this kind of expand and grow and be something that the community is aware of so that next year they know that it's something they can come to and be able to find that produce, and also local growers can come and sell their produce. So it's got a lot of benefits for both ways.
Okay. So again, it's Tuesday, and the hours again are?
Tuesday on September 12th from noon until 4, right in the parking lot at the Health Department, which is at 650 Round Valley Drive.
Okay. Phil, as we all know, we had some very smoky skies this week, and the Health Department decided to pull out its air quality monitoring equipment. I mean, just for your own information, is that why we did it?
Well, typically we run our ozone monitors from May to October. And then we switch over to PM2.5 from October to May. So that's typically ozone. We see problems with that during the summer months. And then PM2.5, we see problems during the winter months. So we were about a month out from firing up the PM2.5 machines anyways. And then with the smoke that you could see in the air and some of the requests that we were getting, we decided it was a good idea to get that started up just a little bit early. Unfortunately, we ran into a few problems. Staff and the Environmental Health Department, we weren't quite ready to have them going, so it took us a day or two longer than we had anticipated. Nonetheless, they're up and running now and providing us with some data that shows that while visually the air is unappealing, the PM2.5 readings are actually fairly moderate and something along the similar lines that we would see during the winter in our basin with the PM2.5. Yesterday, we peaked at about 27, which is still, according to the Utah Air Quality Index, is still in the moderate category. It hasn't reached that level of unhealthiness or being unsafe for those that are have trouble breathing. And so we were able to get some data, and according to some of the weather reports I've seen and the weather moving through, the smoke should start clearing out here in the next day to two. So.
Yeah, so what's important about the PM2.5 is that it's very fine particulate that will, I guess, just embed in your lungs?
Sure, and that's what we hear during the winter months down on the Wasatch Front about the air quality being so bad. That's how they determine is the PM2.5, and it's 2.5 microns big, so extremely small, and it does have the ability to make itself available in the lungs, meaning it gets further down into kind of the structure of the lungs. And so those individuals that have trouble breathing or have restrictive breathing feel the effects of that a lot quicker than just the normal person would, because their breathing is already restricted, and then you start stacking these small particles inside of your lungs, and it makes it difficult to breathe them. the body does have the ability to get rid of those particles through coughing and those sort of things. But if you already have trouble breathing, that becomes a lot more difficult for the body.
Yeah. And something it was just the itchy eyes and my voice obviously got pretty raspy, too. And that's just from the smoke itself as opposed to any particulate.
Right. And it's very similar to when you go camping or you spend the evening by the campfire. That particulate matter is a lot bigger. It's PM10. And so we see that. It's visible. We can see the smoke in the air. We can see the smoke around the campfire. And when you're around a campfire, you have the same reaction. Your eyes are itchy. You have a raspy voice. You can have a cough and that. And so that's what we were mainly experiencing over the last few days. As I said, PM2.5 didn't really reach that critical point. But nonetheless, we received a number of calls from concerned parents and individuals about whether or not it was safe to be outside. And rest assured that had the health department felt at any point it was a critical concern, we would have been the first ones to let the community know that certain precautions needed to be taken.
Okay. And I guess you couldn't use the data at Quinn's just given all the construction there, and you may have had some dust readings in there, huh?
Right. Yeah, we're excited that the Peace House is coming in next door to the health department, but unfortunately our air monitor is right on the property line. And so when we got that fired up yesterday, we noticed that the excavation equipment was at full speed and stirring up some dust as well as the fumes that come off of that equipment. So we realized that was going to influence our results, and so we're reevaluating how we're going to monitor PM2.5 this winter.
All right. And then do you have the readings posted online at this
Correct.
Point?
Correct. Yeah. The website recently underwent a change in its structure. So for the individuals interested, you can go to summitcountyhealth.org. And on the opening page, there's a picture that says residents that you can click. And the fifth hyperlink down says outdoor air quality. And all that information will be available right there.
Okay. Hey, Phil and Serene, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having us.